nature authoritative. And in God's world, He delegates authority to human beings in various spheres. And we talked about three spheres of authority. And so three spheres of life, or we could talk about three institutions who have spheres of authority that are fundamental in God's world. And what were those? Anybody? Family being the foundational institution, the only pre-fall institution established. And then the other two, church and state, civil government. Yes, family, church, and state, or civil government. And so one of the things I'm going to argue really, really foundational, and I can't believe, or I can't remember whether I made this point 2 weeks ago or not, but that all of these, in God's system, ideally, all of these systems of government depend upon the capacity of people for self-government. And I'm going to repeat some things that, and come back to some things that I talk about a lot with respect to other things. We've talked about them before, but they're fundamental categories of thought that help us to understand government properly in a scriptural way. And we introduced 2 weeks ago the concept of covenant. And that's one. When God, and talk about covenant a lot, and some people's heads start spinning when we talk about covenant, because some people think, okay, now what is that? What is covenant? I have this vague idea. But the fundamental thing you need to keep in mind when we talk about covenant, about the definition of covenant is the way that God relates. Okay? God relates even to Himself. The persons of the Trinity relate by making covenant, and in terms of a covenant structure of relationship. So when we think about covenant is the structure of our relationship to God. God makes covenant. And covenant, people think of covenant people have thought of a covenant as a contract. It's actually much deeper than a contract. Like between two parties, you enter into a contract and both bind themselves and obligate themselves, and they sign the covenant or sign the contract. It's similar, but a covenant is deeper in that a covenant involves a bond. It is a relationship that is a deep bond between two people. And when we're talking about God, we're talking about between God and Himself, or God and someone else. When God makes a covenant with anyone other than Himself, it's a covenant between two unequal parties. And so God is the one who sets the terms of the covenant. And so when we're talking about government, we're talking about, in a broad sense, we're talking about this system of delegation. And it is part of the way that we relate to God. The way we relate to authority in life. Now, I want to impress on you, I don't want to make an excuse. I have things in my head, but I'm a little foggy this morning because I've been sick, and so things aren't coming to me as quickly as they usually do. But yeah, well. I hope that hasn't been a problem. If it has, then somebody raise your hand and stop me. I remember being in one class in seminary, and there was a professor who used to come and lecture, and he would have all his notes written out. And this was a guy who was addicted to tobacco. Interesting for a seminary professor, but he would, every kind of tobacco he would use during the course of the day as he was teaching his classes, and he would when he taught his classes, he would have a dip of snuff in his upper lip, and he would sit at the front of the class, and he had this lectern he'd sit before the lectern and he'd kind of look down at his notes and read them. Every once in a while, he'd kind of, his eyes would kind of peer up at us, you know, and look like that, and he'd look back down. And it was all you could do to keep up, because he was just reading his notes, and so he'd just writing furiously. And we would sometimes, when we'd get behind, we'd just, out of sheer desperation, somebody would raise their hand to ask a question just so he'd stop so that we could catch up. So if you want to do that, if you want to raise your hand and out of desperation, that's fine. So I'll just stop and you can kind of ponder for a while. And so, no, ask questions anytime. Okay, so covenant, understanding covenant is really fundamental and essential to understanding government from a biblical point of view. And what I want to do is, the point I never made, I said I was going to make, wasn't sure if I made it 2 weeks ago, self-government is essential to God's understanding of government. The capacity of people to govern themselves. And this is bound up with this whole idea of kingdom, which I talk about a lot. That's what I said I was going to talk about, something I talk about a lot. And when we go back to Genesis, you know, most things in the Bible, most concepts in the Bible begin in the first three chapters of Genesis. The foundation for them is laid in the first three chapters of Genesis. And what you see in the rest of Scripture is usually just an unfolding of the basic things that you see in those first three chapters. So what do we see? Let's remind ourselves of these fundamental things that help orient us when we're thinking about government. Of course, in the first three chapters of Genesis, God establishes himself as creator. And the fact that God is the creator and the fact that God made everything out of nothing itself means that God has ultimate authority. We are obligated to obey the slightest whim of God, and everything that God says and all of God's will, we are obligated to conform to God's will fundamentally because we're creatures. Because God's made us. He has the right, the fundamental right to govern us and to tell us what to do and tell us what to be. And he establishes what we are. And in God's case, although in human cases there's a distinction, and we made this distinction 2 weeks ago, between authority and power, in God, God has all power and he has all authority. And so those go together perfectly. I'm sorry. We talk about the way we have a term for God's governing of his world that he has created, his subsequent governing of what happens in his world. What do we call that? Yeah, we call it providence, God's providence. We're going to talk about providence in the sermon today. But when God created the world, even though the term covenant is not used until later, we see the elements of covenant even in the way God creates the world. And we talked about those last week. And so we've been talking about this true transcendence, which means there's that God is above. He's infinitely above his creation. God is uncreated, and there's a distance between God and his creation, but because God has created man in his image, there's a link there that enables us to understand and know God in a way that nothing else in creation can, because we reflect God, and human beings, that is, male and female. And so when God relates, he establishes a covenant. We have these two concepts of transcendence, God's aboveness, God's the fact that God is unreachable and that he is far off in that sense, combined with this far-off God coming near to enter into a relationship, and we call that immanence, God's nearness. He does that in the covenant by establishing a covenant. And he does this in space and time. God is transcendent to space and time, but what God does is he enters our realm of space and time. In other words, he enters history, and this is why history is so important to the Christian faith, and uniquely to the Christian faith. Other religions talk about philosophy and ideas. Christianity is rooted in things that have actually happened, because what Christianity is asserting is that this transcendent God who is above his creation has entered into history. He's entered into our world. He's accommodated himself to our creatureliness in order to relate to us for his purposes. That's what covenant is. And so you have this bringing together of God's transcendence and his immanence. And his transcendence means, and this relates to government, each one of these points, these elements of a covenant, relate to government. God governs because he is the transcendent one. In other words, he's setting the terms. We don't negotiate the covenant, the terms of the covenant with God. God comes and he governs us, and he governs us through covenant, through entering into a relationship with us. And as he does that, then secondly, and by the way, where do these come from? Where do these elements come from? that we've talked about before. This is largely due to the work of a man named Meredith Klein, who did a lot of work on ancient Near Eastern suzerainty treaties and noticed that the structure of covenants within the Bible roughly paralleled, and somewhat even less than roughly, paralleled the form of these treaties that were between conquering kings and their conquered peoples, suzerains and vassals in the ancient Near East. And so this is a rough summary of elements. And you would have just sections of these covenant documents, these treaties, that would correspond to these different parts. Now, the second part can be summarized as it generally took the form of a historical prologue, which relates to the fact that God enters into history. How does he do that? We could call this mediation as well. When God relates through covenant, there's a mediator. God relates somewhat indirectly. And so there's at least one who represents God to those to whom he is relating and represents them to God. That's a mediator. Represents two parties in two directions. And God always establishes mediation. So in creation, as God is saying, I'm going to relate to the creation, whom does he establish as mediator? Mankind. Yes. He says to mankind, I want you to rule. And we've broken this down before, so we won't do that in detail again. But again, God puts mankind in the place of ruling over the rest of his creation. He doesn't say, I want you to rule in my place. He's saying, I want you to rule for me as my representative. Okay? And it's mankind's creation in God's image that qualifies him to do this. And that's why he says to rule in the same breath that he declares, I'm creating you in my image. Let us make man in our image and let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the beasts of the field. And so this is the first government that God establishes. The headship, the kingship, the rulership of mankind as God's image. It is a kind of government. And notice that it is a kind of mediated government. It's a delegated government. It's not that mankind is taking God's place. It is that mankind is ruling for God, which means that mankind has a responsibility then to rule in a way that reflects God's nature, that reflects who God is. In fact, That's the whole purpose. That's why God has created anything, to glorify himself, to display his excellencies. And so the way that we are to rule is to reflect God's rule. And so you see God, you see Adam being tasked with naming the animals. What's that? Well, that's like God. What do you see in Genesis 1? God naming things. So mankind is doing the things that God did, thinking God's thoughts after him. And there's some, we've talked about this before, but I want to repeat it because it's very important with respect to government and understanding government. If we're to reflect God in the way that we rule, then that means that we are to rule on God's terms. Okay? In other words, as we rule, the position of rulership doesn't entitle us to rule according to our whims, and particularly our autonomous whims. We are to rule according to God and what God has revealed of himself and his will, his revealed will. Now, what do we call God's revealed will? What is God's revealed? What do we call that? Well, yeah, the Bible. But if it's his will, he's saying, I want you to do this. I want you to live like this. I command you to live like this. That's his law. That's his law. Now, just so happens that the third part of the covenant is what we call stipulations. But the sovereign God, when he makes covenant, he says, okay, I'm entering into a relationship, and here's what I expect of you. And that's his law. And so when in creation, we see some representative commands that imply a lot of other things. But we see a negative command, don't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We see positive commands, rule over the fish of the sea, name the animals, tend the garden. All of these various broad and relatively more specific commands, they constitute the revelation, the beginning revelation of God's will with respect to creation and what God, what Adam and Eve do in creation. But the test command, the command about the knowledge of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Let me ask you something about that. And we've been talking about this in men's Bible study recently. We read that story, and it reads kind of almost like a mythological story. And I think the reason it does is because we relate it to fairy tales in the way we understand it. So when we read of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we think of this magical tree in the center of the garden that God tells them not to eat, because if they eat of it, there's this magic that will happen and it will transform them, or they'll die, it's poisonous or something like that. I don't think any of that's true. What's the point of the tree? What makes the tree special is simply that God designated this tree and said, don't eat of it. That's it. There's nothing intrinsically about the tree that's poisonous or anything. What's poisonous about it is that to disobey that command is, it says something about their the way they're relating to God. And God says, you will surely die. Well, when Satan tempts Adam and Eve, what does he do? He creates an alternate scenario, and he says, no, you won't surely die. You'll be like God if you eat that tree, knowing good and evil. Now, this is the way Satan works. What he says is never entirely wrong. Because if it were entirely wrong and absurd, we would never be tempted by it. It wouldn't deceive us. Satan's lies always contain enough of the truth that they look good. They look like they're right. And what we find is they're right, but not in the way that we thought they were. And so, Adam and Eve, let me ask you this. They weren't to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Does that mean God doesn't want us to know good and evil? Does God not want us to know the difference between good and evil? The rest of the Bible tells us that God wants us to be able to discern good from evil. In fact, that's what marks maturity. But it's how we know good and evil. How does God want us to know good and evil? This is what this test was all about. How do we know it's good and evil? Do we know it through experience? Do we know it through experiencing evil? Or do we know it simply because we trust what God has said? What God says, that's good. What God's will, that's good. I simply trust it. That's how I know good and evil. I look at God's law. Conformity to God's law is good. Rebelling against God's law is evil. That's how we're to know good and evil. We're not to know good and evil by disobeying God's law, God's word, by failing to trust Him, by choosing not to believe Him and go our own way and then find out what good and evil are like. Yeah, and Adam and Eve would come to know good and evil like God if they ate the tree of the tree, but it wouldn't be the great thing that Satan's presenting it as being. So the potential for evil existed. It didn't exist until it was actually perpetrated. But the potential for it existed, yes. And when Adam and Eve eat the fruit, and it's Eve's eating that's described in the most detail, and so we can comment on it. When did she eat? I've pointed this out many, many times in sermons and lessons. The text says she ate when she saw that the fruit was pleasing to the eye and good for food and desirable for making one wise. Now, could she literally see all of that? Could she see that it was good for food before she ate it? Could she literally see that it was desirable for making one wise? That's just taking into account what the serpent, what Satan was saying to her would happen, would be true if she ate. She couldn't see all of that literally. What that's talking about is what's going on in her mind. She's saying, here's how this situation looks to me. And so the real test, again, was not will I believe God or will I believe Satan. That's involved in it. But really, this test is what is going to be my criterion for determining truth and determining reality, and what my action will be. Is it simply what God has said? What God has said defines reality for me. If God says it, that's true. Is that the way I look at things? Or do I reserve the right? And listen, this is absolutely key. Okay? This is one of the most fundamental things that you can ever think about in your relationship to God. You either trust God, what He said, the Creator, the transcendent one who knows everything, or you say, I'm going to presume the right to sit in judgment on what God has said and determine for myself whether I think it's right or not, based on my perspective. Now, think about that for a second. Think about, just from an objective point of view, how foolish that is. Because none of us has an ultimate perspective. None of us has an ultimate perspective. None of us can see everything. We are little specks, and we have one little speck of experience. And we know one little speck of knowledge. And God knows everything. And God is everywhere, and God experiences everything. And what He says flows out of that comprehensive perspective. Our evaluation of anything is extremely limited. And so for us, from that limited perspective, to presume to say, okay, what God said, because He sees the whole picture. For me to look at it from my limited perspective and sit in judgment on what God says is incredibly foolish. Few things could be more foolish than that. And yet that's what sin is. That's what Eve did. She said, well, looks to me like what Satan says is right. I'm going to go with that. And so she ate. And that's what we always do when we sin. Think about it. We always do that. Whenever we sin, we say, I know better than God. I can see better. I don't trust what God has said for whatever reason. I don't trust His perspective. The illustration I always use with this is if you want to know what a fishbowl is like, if you're a fish, can you really know what the fishbowl is really like? You're inside the fishbowl. You have a certain perspective. Think about it, being a fish and looking out through the fish. Can you really tell what the fishbowl is like? You really can't. The only way you can know what the fishbowl is like is if you could get outside the fishbowl and you didn't need to be in the water, and you could get out and you could look at the whole thing and you could see all the other little fishies swimming around in there, and you could say, oh, yeah, I was there, yeah. And then you really understand. But unless you have that kind of perspective, you don't really understand the total picture. And you don't really understand your experience as a fish in the fishbowl unless you could get out. And what God's Word does is it gives us that perspective. It gives us a transcendent perspective on our lives. It gives us a transcendent perspective on everything. And God hasn't revealed everything to us. As a matter of fact, we couldn't know everything. Our minds aren't big enough to know everything that He does. But He has chosen to reveal what we need to know. And so this whole thing of government and our relationship to God's law, God's law, you know, Satan tries to present God's law like he did to Eve as something that oppresses us and keeps us from the best. God's restricting us, and because he's restricting us, he's holding back his best from us. And the only way we can have his best is if we reject what he says and go our own way and make our own choices and act on our own limited perspectives and act autonomously, independently from him. But you can see from this presentation how utterly foolish that is. The truth is this, that God has made his world work a certain way. And the only way we can really have true joy and fulfillment is to abide by God's rules, because what God's rules do is they make our lives work. This is the other concept that's relevant to this is the concept of freedom. You know, Satan says his lie is we're not free unless we shake off the restrictions of God's Word. But those restrictions are the very things that make our lives work. And so we have to redefine freedom properly. Again, as I've said a lot of times in the past, freedom is not being able to do whatever you want to do. Freedom, it's not the removal of all restrictions. Freedom is the removal of every obstacle to being what God has designed me to be. That's freedom. Freedom is a train running on the tracks rather than wildly out of control in a field somewhere. Freedom is my fulfilling my potential by abiding by the things that God has, the restrictions, the strictures, the structure that God's built into his universe. I've got a million illustrations about this. I've used them before. If you want to communicate in a foreign country, what do you have to do? You have to learn the conventions and the restrictions and the strictures and the structure of the language that those people speak. And you have to abide by that. And that, what does that do? It frees you, because now you can communicate. If you just say, well, you know, I don't want to abide by those conventions of their language. I'm just gonna make up my own convictions. And you start repeating a bunch of nonsense syllables, blah, 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 blah. You know, nobody's gonna know what you're saying. It doesn't matter if you want to be free or not. You're not free. You're bound. You're in prison. You're imprisoned within yourself. You can't communicate with anybody around you. If you want to communicate, what do? You have to learn the language. And you have to abide by the rules of that language. All of life is like that. All of life is like that in God's world. Okay? And that's why God, that's the way we look at God's law is absolutely essential. God's law is a blessing, not a curse. It's not something that keeps the best from us. It is the path to the best. But more importantly, for what we're talking about in terms of government, the law is given to us to show us how we reflect God's character. The law is the embodiment of who God is. It's the embodiment of His character. And so it's the guide to us for how we exercise our dominion that God has given us. The law then is the tool, God's law is the tool of dominion, of our dominion. It's what we do in order to do what God has created us to do. Okay? And so this whole business of do we do things on our terms based on our limited perspective and go our own way? Or do we submit to God's law, which always involves, if it's a true submission to God's law, faith. It always involves trusting God, that God knows what he's saying. He knows what he's doing. And that he is good, and that his will for us is best. And so even when it is counterintuitive, even when it goes against how things look to me, no, I go with what God says because I realize God's perspective is transcendent, and because I'm obligated to obey him, and because I trust him. This is why you can't separate faith and works. Works are the expression of faith in God, of works of obedience. And that's central to the covenant, because God says, as I obey those stipulations, then I get either blessing or cursing. When we talk about sanctions, we're talking about blessing or cursing. The way we're blessed in terms of this covenant relationship with God, the way we're blessed is by trusting God in such a way that we obey his law, we obey his stipulations, and then we're blessed. If we disobey, we're cursed. This is what we learn from the very beginning. This is what God emphasizes in the Mosaic Covenant, in that largest and most formal statement of the law and our relationship to it, God's people's relationship to it. So, and then, of course, continuity has to do with then how is this perpetuated into the future? And we'll talk more about that. So, when we talk about any kind of government, then the fundamental hierarchy or mediation is mankind's government of the world. But these principles apply to any government that God has established. The fundamental institution being family. Ideally, if there had been no fall, we could say. And, of course, you're always on shaky ground when you start talking about potentialities, because God ordained things to shake out exactly like they did, and they did. So, but can speak perspectively that if there had been no fall, there would have been no need for any institution other than family. Our relationships, the relationships of everyone in the world would be familial relationships. And that's why when God begins to restore this and recreate this through his church, how does he teach us to talk about each other? And what does he do? He establishes a new family. And he teaches us to talk about each other in terms of fathers and sons and brothers and sisters and familial relationships. But even there, when God establishes the family, he establishes a government. He says that the husband is the head. Husband is the head of the wife. And then parents have authority over children. And so there's a governmental structure in the family. There's also a governmental structure in the church. And again, when we talk about these different institutions, We're talking about different spheres of authority. And so when we talk about then, I think, I can't remember how much of this we talked about last time, but some of this may be repeated. Family, church, state, they have distinctive spheres, and there is something distinctive about each one. Now, we could summarize, but I think we did do this. We gave some illustrations. For instance, where is the education of children primarily delegated by God? The authority for the education of children. Okay, family in this sphere. To what institution is delegated the power associated with capital punishment? The state. And this has not always been well understood. It's not the church. Although part of the reason this was not well understood is because in Israel you have a merger of church and state. So Israel is both the church of the Old Testament and a state. In the New Covenant, you have a separation of these, and here's where there is a legitimate sense of the separation of church and state. That doesn't separation of church and state, really the way it's used by secularists today, effectively means separation of state and God. And from a Christian perspective, that's impossible. It's God who ordained the state, and the state is to be run according to His rules, just like the church is to be run according to His rules. But there's a separation between the two in that they are different. They have different spheres of authority, and they have certain distinctive things about their authority that don't overlap or don't translate from one to the other. So the church doesn't have the power of capital punishment. Hasn't always understood that in history, or sometimes it's used the state to enforce ecclesiastical rule, and we can't get into all the ins and outs of this today, but it is a fascinating topic, and the church needs to keep talking about this and hammering out what it thinks about these things as part of hammering out its continuing call and responsibility to hammer out orthodoxy. What is orthodoxy? What we then want to focus on is we want to focus on the state to close this out in the rest of our discussion. Because that's usually, when we talk about government, that's what most people are talking about. They're talking about the state. And so I have just enough time to make one more point, and then I want to leave some time for questions. The most, and I've already sort of predisposed you to answer this a certain way, in the philosophical framework that we've and theological framework we've presented so far, but I want to put it out there: the most salient question for most people today, and Christians as they're relating to non-Christians, with respect to civil government, is this. Where does God's law come in? Is the civil government to use God's law as a guide for its laws and its enforcement of laws? And, I would say that the discussions of this between Christians and non-Christians is accompanied by a whole lot of heat and often very little light. But we can notice some historical things. We can say Well, you know, and people point this out. We got the Ten Commandments posted in most of our courtrooms. And our founding fathers appealed to the Bible and said, you know, our laws are based on the Ten Commandments and are based on the Bible. Well, okay, but then you have a lot of people today saying, well, that's impossible because the Constitution means that we have to have freedom of religion, so we can't base any of our laws on any one. We can't base our laws on any one religion. And so you have this confused state of affairs, and you have people going back and forth saying, and then you have Christians who say, well, we don't want a theocracy. And when they say this, most Christians just say, oh, that's right, we don't want a theocracy. Because they think of Islam, and they think of an Islamic theocracy, and they think, well, boy, that's ugly, I don't want that. Or they think in church history of times when there have been attempts to set up communities based on God's law, and they think of that as a theocracy, and they think of, and rightly point out, abuses and some really horrible situations in history that resulted from that. And so they say, well, the whole concept of a theocracy is flawed. But here's what I would ask fundamentally. I would ask this. What does theocracy mean? This means the rule of God, right? Here's the question. If you don't want God to rule, whom do you want to rule? Is anybody else's rule going to be better than God's rule? And isn't really what we're talking about that we don't want an ecclesiocracy? What do we mean by that? Rule by the church. The church becoming the civil government. I think that's really been the flaw. And a failure to recognize the legitimate distinction, the legitimate separation between the institutions of church and state. There is a legitimate separation of church and state. But what as a Christian, I think what we need to assert is that both are to be equally under God. And under the one true God, not just under any God, not just under a God. So we can say, well, we're inserting the concept of God in there. No, it's got to be the one true God. As Christians, we have an idea of who that is. It's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. It's the one who supremely revealed himself in Jesus Christ. It's the one whose law has been revealed in the Old and New Testaments. And so, yes, the application of that law involves some thought because the revelation of that law was given historically. And because it was given historically, we have to take historical progressive development into account. We have to take into account the progression of God's plan of redemption as it has played out in history. What things were like before God sent the Messiah, what things were like since he sent the Messiah. That's the major watershed, but there are other progressive developments as well. We have to take all that into account as we look at the laws of the Bible and we apply them as they were given in that time to our time. And sometimes that's complex. Okay, it's complex, but it's not undoable. And we need to be about it, I would say, because my major thesis is this, that if we depart from God's law, then we're into the kingdom of Satan. We're into doing things according to our whims. We're into doing things autonomously, and that cannot result in God's blessing, ever. It can't. So societally, I would say we have to affirm the propriety of God's law as our guide. And that's what is commonly known as the second use of the law in the minds of the reformers. the so-called civic use of the law, restraining unrighteousness generally in societies. Okay, I'm going to stop there just really quickly, and we've got more to say, obviously, as we then apply this, but we set the stage for then applying this specifically and making some statements about implications for how we look at government. But does anybody have any questions? I'm about to lose my voice anyway. That was such an excellent presentation and so thorough and so clear that nobody has any questions, right?
Well,
yeah. Yeah. Several things you have to say. I was going to reserve this for next week, but I'll just say this. I mean, what Tyler's saying is just absolutely right. If you make any law, you have a religion. You're taking sides with respect to religion. I've made this point before. Because you're making that law based on some ultimate idea of what's right and wrong. Where does that come from? It comes from your religion, your religious point of view. And if you take this religious point of view, you're necessarily ruling out contrary religious points of view. If you have any law at all, you have the legislation of a religion, a religious perspective. There is no way to avoid that. The notion of pluralism is really impossible. We don't have pluralism. You can't have pluralism and have law. It's why, you know, my favorite example of this is we don't have law can't be religiously neutral. Why don't we have ritual cannibalism in this country? It's said that we have pluralism. Why don't we have ritual cannibalism? Why don't we allow that? That's a religious point of view. We take sides, don't we? Because we say we're still coasting on the residue of our Christian past. We still have enough sense to recognize that no, that's not proper. We can't allow that. But why not? There are societies that do, and they have a different religion. We say from a Christian perspective, no, that's not proper. And so we're going to legislate against that. Every single law does that.
Where that line is, where God's law is appropriately applied to public life. Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to assert one other thing ahead of time today that we're going to develop next week. If you reject God's law, what does it lead to? It leads to bondage. It leads to slavery. The kingdom of Satan is a kingdom of slavery. It is a kingdom of oppression. When Satan says God's kingdom is oppressive, but what really happens and what you see happening in history is that regimes, governments that reject God's law become by definition oppressive. Eve. And this is the book of Judges, writ large in our governmental system. But we want to show how that's true next week. Okay, that's it.